Good morning and welcome to Midpoint, your midweek, mid-morning news and public affairs show with a local perspective. I'm Janet Scherberger, and the amazing Lamar Robinson is answering the phones for us today. It's a special Wavemakers edition of Midpoint, where we go deep with someone who's making a difference in the Tampa Bay region. In the studio with me is State Representative Fentress Driscoll, a rising star in the Florida Democratic Party, who was first elected to office in 2018, defeating Republican incumbent Sean Harrison to represent the new Tampa area. Representative Driscoll is a partner at the Carlton Fields Law Firm, where she specializes in business law. She's a graduate of Harvard University, where she was the first African-American elected president of student government. And she's in line to be the House Democratic Party leader in 2024. Welcome to the show, Representative Driscoll. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Janet. Thank you for having me.
WMNF listeners, if you have a question for Representative Driscoll or want to share your thoughts on the goings-on in Tallahassee, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or send us an email at dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885. We have a lot to talk about today. Representative Driscoll served in the last session on the Pandemics and Public Emergencies Committee, so we're going to touch a little bit on how Governor DeSantis is handling the pandemic, and she was on the Judiciary Committee, so we'll want to talk about criminal justice reform. And listeners, if you have thoughts on those topics or a question for the representative, give us a call, 239-9663, or send us an email at dj@wmnf.org. But before we get to that, we want to talk a little bit, Representative Driscoll, about how you got to here. You grew up in Lakeland and in high school, where you were a cheerleader and played tennis, and you also got involved in student government. Tell me a little bit about that. How did that come about?
Sure. So, you know, I just always like doing many things, because you're probably thinking, like, what does cheerleading have to do with tennis, has to do with drama, has to do with, you know, student government? But I was just a very involved student. And so I had also a great role model in my eldest sister. Her name's Sharita. She's a teacher over in Polk County. And she was the first Black student in my high school to be president of the senior class, which was kind of a big deal. And being a middle child, you know, and an overachiever, it made me want to follow in her footsteps. So, you know, it gave me that great role model to follow. And so I wound up being class president all 4 years because, again, middle child, overachiever.
Oh, that's so funny. I was like that with my sister. I always wanted to be just like her. So then you were president of the student body all 4 years, but that's kind of unusual. It wasn't like that in my high school.
Yeah, you know, and so we had our student government, and then we also had our class president. So I was class president all 4 years. I was involved in student government. I was not student government president. I was an officer or did something, I don't know. But that was, you know, that was who planned all the prom and the homecoming. So I was certainly involved, but did not lead that. But class president, that was great because, you know, you really got to stand up for your classmates and kind of interface with administration anytime there was a problem. And what I didn't realize is that it means that for life now, I am charged with planning all of our class reunions. But it's a lot of fun though, right? It's a lot of fun to be able to serve your classmates in that way.
And I understand the first time you actually debated on the House floor in Tallahassee, you were actually in high school. So how did that happen and what was that experience like and how did it impact you?
That's a great story. So, you know, I actually thought I wanted to be an engineer, Janet. Like, I was a student who would do science projects even when they weren't required because I loved it, and thought I wanted to be an engineer. And you can hear role models. It's an important thing in my life. There was a kid I looked up to. He was a couple of grades ahead of me, but he was really smart. He was also a Black student, and there weren't a ton of us in the AP classes. And his name was Lawrence, and Lawrence was going to FAMU, and he was going to be a drum major, and he was going to be an engineer. So I was going to go to FAMU, be drum major, be an engineer. It was a flawed plan from the beginning because I play no instruments, but I modeled myself after him until 11th grade when I took AP government and economics, and that class changed my life, and my teacher changed my life, Chris Taylor. He's actually a businessman here in Tampa now, and we're still friends. But he saw that I really took to the subject matter, particularly the government aspect of it. And he had me apply to YMCA youth and government programs and all sorts of stuff, Model United Nations, but especially Florida Girl State. And so I participated in that program through the American Legion, got to visit Tallahassee, learn about government at every level. I was completely hooked. And while there, got to serve in a number of roles, including governor of Girl State, I'm dating myself, but I got to meet Lawton Chiles, who was the governor at the time, and it gave me the bug and, you know, kind of shifted me away from the hard sciences and more towards studying government.
And so that's what you did then. You went on to Harvard University, and what did you get your degree in there? What did you study?
In government, yeah.
Government,
I studied
okay.
Government, sure.
And were elected student body president there, and you also, hidden talents, you were the in the Kumba Singers, according to the bio on your official State of Florida page, so you may not have played an instrument, but can you sing?
No, I'm horrible. So the thing about Kumba Singers, though, which is great, and it's all about creativity, and it celebrates creativity through Black music, and it was the most diverse, like the largest and most diverse student organization on campus. And what's great about it is that there are no auditions, but we would practice, I'm talking for hours and hours each week. And so by the end of a semester, you could carry a tune, but you really had to stick with it. So I used to be a little better. Right now, you know, I'm totally out of practice and can't carry a tune. But a funny story about the Kumba Singers is at Harvard, we had a special convocation honoring Nelson Mandela. And so the Kumba Singers were invited to sing the South African national anthem for him. So I got to meet Nelson Mandela while singing
oh,
with
that's cool.
Kumba. Yeah.
So you, at Georgetown, you were in Washington, D.C. Were you engaged much with what was happening in the Capitol, and what was your impression of Washington?
You know, it was an intentional choice to go to law school in D.C., knowing that I was interested in politics. I was able to take a seminar course with Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's the congressional representative for Washington, D.C., which was amazing. And one of our assignments was to go and listen to a committee hearing, which was really cool. Some of my friends and I slept outside of the Supreme Court for 2 days so that we could get in for the oral argument for these affirmative action hearings that were coming up. I mean, it was just an electric place.
Mm-hmm.
Former President Barack Obama was there campaigning for his U.S. Senate campaign. And, you know, I got to be at one of his fundraisers and meet him. I mean, it just, everything in the political world was happening in D.C. It was the center of the universe. So it was great.
Cool. And now you are at Carlton Fields, where you focus mostly on business law. So that would explain how you ended up on the Insurance and Banking Committee, perhaps.
Right.
And what drew you to that practice area?
Sure. So, I've been with Carlton Fields now for about 15 years, which is a while to think about. But so most of my clients are businesses or banks. So I do business litigation, commercial litigation, which can mean a variety of things. But it certainly has prepared me well, I think, to understand, to understand business. And as a lawmaker, the way I translate that, is it good for business? Is it good for people? Then it's probably something that we should be doing. If we can't find that sweet spot, then maybe that's not a policy we should be looking at.
Okay, so interestingly then, I know that you did not score particularly high among lawmakers, state lawmakers with associated industries in Florida, which is a big business trade association in Tallahassee. So is that something that concerns you? And why do you think that is, that they're not huge fans of yours?
You know, it doesn't concern me in the sense that I'm loyal and accountable to my constituents, and I will always vote in the way that is best for them. So, we had some bills this session that I thought were very bad for people. They were touted as good for business. I'm not even sure that they're good for business. One of them was a COVID liability bill that basically shields businesses. It almost gives them like blanket immunity from any sort of COVID liability if they weren't following protocols or didn't have, the requisite sort of PPE and things in place. And to me, that's wrong, because what about the workers? What about the little guy, right? So I was honored to support a different piece of legislation that included a COVID liability shield, but also was more protective of workers. It was carried by Representatives Evan Jenny and Representative Andrew Lernet, who's here in Hillsborough County. So I saw a better way forward, but they didn't, that's ultimately not the bill that was passed, but I stand by that. And by the way, Progress Florida gave me a 100% score, A+ in terms of being an advocate and champion for the people. So that's the score that is closest to my heart.
That makes sense. We do have Robert from Polk County is on the phone. And Robert, I'll get to you in a minute. If you want to ask a question of Representative Driscoll, give us a call, 813-239-9663, or send us an email at dj@wmnf.org. So what motivated you to run for office in 2018? How did that come about?
Sure. So, it had been a part of my life's dream for a long time. But if I'm very candid, you know, I wound up having a great law practice, having a great career, had been involved in the community, serving on nonprofit boards and doing community service. And so I kind of let that dream slip. But after the 2016 election, I just felt like I was watching what was happening in our democracy. And I could see that political conversation and public discourse was becoming far more acrimonious. And people, it didn't seem like people across the aisle could even talk to each other. And you see, I think, where that intensity led us on January 6th, right? We had an armed insurrection where folks tried to bring down our democracy. And I could see even the traces of that then, that our democracy was under attack and it was threatened. I also looked at the Florida House and saw at that time it was fewer than 25% women, I want to say. And that's out of balance, mm-hmm. right? In Florida, our population is slightly more than 50% women. I felt like it also needed more diversity in other ways, and that I had something to offer. So I decided to run.
Why the legislature? Is that the reason for running for the legislature, because of the makeup of it? Did you consider any other office?
Well, I did, but I would encourage, especially for anyone out there who may be thinking about running for office, you really have to do some soul searching about the issues that are most important to you. And for me, you can hear that public education is very important to me. I'm a product of Florida's public schools. My mom was a public school teacher for over 35 years. So the desire to have an impact there, to have an impact on environmental issues, criminal justice reform issues, all of that is handled at the state level. And so it seemed to me that the state legislature would be the best fit.
Well, speaking of that, as I mentioned earlier in the show, you were on the Pandemics and Public Emergencies Committee in 2021. I got to ask you, how do you think Ron DeSantis is doing with handling the pandemic?
Right. And when you told me you might ask me about that, my question to you was, are nonverbal responses allowed? Because my response is, it is rough. It is what is frustrating to me is that we've gotten to a place where even public health has been politicized. So we have a governor who is doing precious little to push prevention. We have a governor who is putting our school districts on their heels, threatening to take funding away, who's using our children as political pawns, when in reality, we should just be following the science. We need to try to get through this together. It is a public health concern. No one party owns this. No one governor owns this. The president doesn't even own this. Like it's incumbent upon all of us to do what we can to try to get through this. And when you consider that Florida's chief economic driver is tourism, it is concerning to me that our chief executive is playing politics. We suffered major setbacks economically throughout this pandemic. And if it were not for the American Rescue Plan dollars that we received from the Biden administration, our budget would have suffered a $9 billion shortfall. That's huge. Mm-hmm. You know, that's funding for roads. That's funding for our schools. So I've been disappointed in Governor DeSantis's pandemic response. I think at the time when Florida was doing better, he was getting all of the credit, when in reality, the credit should have gone to our mayors and county commissions and city commissions who were making the tough decisions to require people to wear masks or, you know, social distance and stay at home. So no, I think that Governor DeSantis's response to the pandemic has been failed. I think that he has tried to distract from that failed response by, creating these sort of political controversies like he's doing with the schools. And while it may satisfy his base, it does nothing to keep Floridians safer. And the public deserves better than that.
Every conflict he faces turns into a fundraising pitch. I mean, he had this last week, the dust up with the Associated Press, and that turned into a fundraising pitch. It all turns into a fundraising pitch for him.
That's right. And let's talk about what he's fundraising for, though, right, Janet? We know that this governor has his eyes set on running for president in 2024. You know, his ambition is clouding his ability to govern Florida from a place of logic and reason and a place of putting Floridians' best interests in mind. And that's problematic. It's corrupt. And like I said, the people of Florida deserve much better.
And then the latest news that we had also just this week is that about $800 million available to Florida for meals for food assistance for children, and the state has not asked for that. Why do you think that might be?
Again, playing politics. You know, and I think he's taken his eye off the ball. So when you're focused on, you know, flying in jets all around the country raising money for your presidential campaign, you know, maybe you forget to do things like get that money and get it distributed to the people in Florida who need it most. I'm so glad that you asked the question, because I think that those are stories that go under the radar. You know, the fact that there's money for our schools that hasn't been distributed also, right? We need to make sure that the public knows this and that they are paying attention, and so that this, you know, these issues can bubble up to the surface, so maybe we can get some pressure applied and get these funds released.
We've had Robert waiting on the line very patiently, so I'm going to bring him on in a minute. I want to let you all know, if you would like to give us a call, the number is 813-239-9663, or you can send us an email to dj@wmnf.org, or send a text to 813-433-0885. So Robert, you're on the line. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Representative Driscoll. Thank you so much for giving this conversation to the public and having me having the honor of being able to talk to you. I want to know your opinion on a couple bills that have been floating around the Florida government. One is Senate bill. I believe these are correct, but the nature of them will make you know what ones I'm talking about. One, I think, is Senate Bill 401, and the other is House Bill 35. And what they're trying to do is eliminate the need to make public notices printed in local newspapers. And I think that would be a terrible thing to permit that. Newspapers have been informing the public and revealing the activities of government for hundreds of years. And to eliminate that would allow the government, local governments, to pass things, and many people wouldn't even know. And if you're if the concern is the digital age, well, most newspapers have a digital version too, so they could see the public notices. But they need to be printed for the public. I will just hang on and listen to your thoughts on those bills, Representative. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Robert.
Well, thank you so much, Robert. First of all, it's my honor to speak with you and that you would take time out of your day to call in. Thank you for being an informed citizen and for caring about these issues. So I do recall House Bill 35. It was carried by Representative Randy Fine. And like you said, it would be a seismic shift in the way that Florida handles public notices. And that's a bill that I've seen during both of my terms of the legislature, and I've voted against it both times and have debated against it both times because of some of the very reasons that you brought out. I mean, first of all, it assumes many things about Florida households that I think are untrue. So we know that in Florida, we have many rural areas where there is a great digital divide, where our families don't have access to broadband. And then what the pandemic showed, excuse me, hiding in plain sight, there are many urban areas where there's a digital divide and people don't have the requisite internet access that they need in their households. And so the other point of that is that additionally, you know, we have all of these local newspapers that families rely on to get their information, and these newspapers have been around. They're, you know, staples of the community. They provide jobs. So, you know, this notice bill is a bill that nobody needed and nobody really asked for. So it's problematic to me, and I've been against it for the many reasons that you've mentioned. I can foresee a time where perhaps we may be able to make that shift to total digital notifications in Florida, but that time has not yet come. We have more work to do to close the digital divide. So thank you for the conversation on that today, Robert. I appreciate it.
And I'm sure my many friends in the media appreciate that, Representative Driscoll. So criminal justice reform was a really big deal in the last session. And explain how that came about at a time when we have a Republican dominated legislature. And I know that, you know, you mentioned the fact that one of the reasons why you wanted to get into politics and in state politics was to try to reach across the aisle and bring some civility to our politics. And my understanding is that that's what you tried to do with this, that you were working really hard with the House Speaker on that bill. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So House Bill 7051 is the police reform bill that we were able to get passed unanimously in both chambers of the legislature. It does a number of important things and fundamentally changes how we will handle basic training in Florida. With this bill, officers will now be trained that they have a duty to intervene. So if anything like what happened to George Floyd occurred and there were other officers standing around, they would know that they had a duty to intervene and stop their colleague from engaging in that bad behavior. Training on a duty to render medical assistance, limiting the use of chokeholds. It also requires greater transparency such that use of force incidents, if they meet certain criteria, will now have to be reported to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Additionally, if an officer resigns or is terminated under investigation and tries to go to a new employer, they have to provide a sworn affidavit providing information about that to their prospective employer. It also establishes a minimum age of arrest in Florida, which I can't believe we didn't have before.
Right.
But it was inspired by a little girl in Orlando, Kaya Rawl, who was arrested while she was 6 years old, arrested in her classroom. You know, we should not be traumatizing our babies in that way. So the bill does a number of really great things. And when you consider that this was also the same legislative session where we had House Bill 1, which was that horribly tragic anti-protester bill that right. I believe tramples on all of our First Amendment rights and directly pokes a finger in the eyes of Black Lives Matter protesters, I know there are some who are wondering, okay, how did we get House Bill 7051 passed? But it was a collaborative effort between the Florida Legislative Black Caucus, the House and Senate Democratic caucuses, and the Republican leadership. And I was tapped to serve as kind of like the lead negotiator with all of that. I will tell you that coming back to Tallahassee this session, everybody's heart was heavy in terms of what happened to George Floyd and his murder. Everybody, regardless of party, everybody felt like something needed to be done. You know, and I would say that it's the art of compromise. So listen, does it go as far as I would want? No. Does it go further than some of my colleagues across the aisle would want? Yes. And that's how I know that it's a good bill, that it's a good first step forward.
Well,
it's a compromise.
There have been some criticisms of it. A couple weeks ago ran some sound from Senators Jeff Brandis and Daryl Roussan, who were disappointed at how far those bills did not go, or that bill did not go. I imagine there'll be more coming back next year, that it's always you're beating this drumbeat year after year after year. Are you hopeful or skeptical that next year you will make progress again? Or is it just that, as you said, people's hearts were heavy because of George Floyd and there's not a tragedy to drive them this year?
Well, I do think, and you know, about the criticism, man, you want to talk about strong champions for criminal justice reform. Senator Roussan and Senator Brandis certainly have been some of our strongest voices in that area.
And let's give a good strong shout out to Senator Brandis, because he is a Republican
who
has advocated really, really strongly on criminal justice reform. One of the strongest voices.
He is, and he has strong libertarian leanings, which I can understand and oftentimes identify with, right? And that you want to give individuals the best opportunity possible in life so that they can build a good and healthy and prosperous life. So that resonates with me. But what I would say is that I think it opens the door. And I don't think, you know, talking to people who've been around this process much longer than I have, we've not seen anything like this before in the Florida legislature. And so to me, it opens the door for further conversation and where I'd like to see that conversation go. You know, one thing I learned talking with police chiefs and sheriffs around the state about this is that they don't always have the funding they need to do some of the things that we would consider basic, like, for example, the acquisition of body cameras. That's something that not only helps keep the community safe and informed, but also keeps our officers safe so that we can see what happens with incidents, you know, interactions between law enforcement and the community. So, you know, I would love to see the legislature provide funding for these agencies who otherwise couldn't afford the acquisition of body cameras, and perhaps also put some standards around the use of body cameras. I just think that the passage of House Bill 7051 really opens the door for us to have conversations. And it was a special moment in the legislature where I felt like we stopped looking at each other as maybe enemies or opponents, and we're really working together to figure out how we could get things done. And I don't just mean Republicans and Democrats. I mean, you know, the Legislative Black Caucus and law enforcement and community stakeholders and allies. Mm-hmm. It took everyone to get that done.
This was not your first year looking at, as I mentioned, criminal justice reform. There have been other in previous years, and one that I wanted to talk about was in 2019. There was the Dignity. This was your first year in the legislature, the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act, which included things like, and this did pass, requiring state correctional facilities to provide incarcerated women with certain healthcare products, like feminine hygiene products, and it provided requirements for male correctional employees in certain circumstances, for example, like being around inmates when they are undressed or doing body cavity searches, and different kind of requirements to just basically really stop abuse. And again, you talked about how this year there was a bill that passed that set a minimum age for arrests. Why did we even need something like that? Similarly here, this is a bill that, shocking that we wouldn't even need something like that, but tell me, you co-sponsored that bill, and tell me why that was important to you.
Right. That's a bill that was carried by now Senator, but former Representative Chevron Jones out of Miami in Broward County. And I got to tell you, you're so right, Janet. Why on earth would we need a bill like that? But that's a great example of the legislative process working, in that I think that was an issue that came to Senator Jones's attention, and he thought, you know, we've got to do something about this. And he worked really hard to build up support. I was honored to be a co-sponsor. I remember some of the advocates, formerly incarcerated women, came to Tallahassee to meet with us and to share their lived experience of having been incarcerated and not having access to those very basic human needs. And it was compelling. And so that was one I was very honored to sponsor. And I think there's even more work to be done in our prisons, in our correctional facilities, for sure, for sure.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. This is Midpoint. I'm Janet Scherberger, and I'm here with State Representative Fentress Driscoll. Also this year sponsored the Abandoned Cemeteries Bill, which you sponsored in 2020, and it did just pass in 2021. And I'm wondering, for listeners who don't know, that is a bill that looks at, there were a newspaper reporter here in the Tampa area, Paul Guzzo, revealed that there were a lot of African-American cemeteries that had just basically been paved over, built over, forgotten, and ignored. And so this bill addresses those, and I'll ask you to speak about that in a minute. But it did not pass last year, but it did pass this year, and I'm wondering why you think there was a difference this year, and I'm wondering also if it was like the George Floyd effect. Perhaps that's why it passed.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, so this one I was honored to carry with Senator Janet Cruz, and we did bring it in 2020, and we tried to work it then, but we came back in 2021, and Senator Cruz was actually able to get movement on it in the Senate, and she was able to secure funding for Zion, which is here in Tampa, and which was, I think, the impetus for so much of this, in Paul Guzzo's reporting. And then for 2021, well, we took a different tactic. So in the off season, we engaged the Secretary of State, Florida Secretary of State, Laurel Lee, in her office, because that's really the office where a task force on this would need to be housed. We kept meeting with them. We kept meeting with the community stakeholders to keep abreast of what was happening at Zion. And then the Florida Professional Archaeological Network, we kept meeting with them to make sure that we were, you know, what we had in the bill actually could be, you know, like the best language that the bill could be. We kept working it with the committee chairs, and then we worked it harder to get more bipartisan support and to get our colleagues across the aisle to sign on. And so we created more awareness around the bill. So, you know, certainly George Floyd's death, I think, completely changed the world and opened up America to have conversations about race in ways that maybe we hadn't had since the Civil Rights Movement. So I think that, you know, I don't want to deny that could be a possibility of the effect, but I will also be very candid and share with you that we worked the bill in a different way. We never stopped working that bill. Mm-hmm. And what you'll see in Tallahassee sometimes is that it can take multiple sessions to accomplish a policy goal. And I think this is an example of that happening. But we were able to get it passed this time. The task force is already meeting. Both Senator Cruz and I have been appointed to the task force. And so we're already underway in trying to right some of those historical wrongs.
Great. So you've already started meeting?
Yes. So we had our first meeting in August, and I anticipate July, and I anticipate our next meeting will be in September.
And the point of that is that you're going to be looking at how you address and how you honor the people that were buried in these cemeteries, correct?
That's right. And also looking to see whether there need to be any legislative or policy changes accompanying that so that we can accomplish it. Florida had an abandoned cemeteries task force in 98, and that actually led to a lot of the policy that we see on the books in Florida statutes now. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's some new policy that comes out of this task force.
WMNF listeners, if you want to ask a question of Representative Driscoll, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or send us an email at dj@wmnf.org. So we were talking about the abandoned cemeteries. There's something else that you're involved in right now, talking about righting wrongs, which is the lynching memorial that I think you're working on.
Yes.
With City Council member Luis Vieira. What's the status of that?
Right, with Councilman Vieira and Tammy Spratling, who's the CEO over at Community Tampa Bay, and then also Fred Hearns, who's a local historian.
Oh, Fred, he's great.
Yeah, and then we got Robert over at Abe Brown Ministries. It's just a great coalition of community leaders who are working on this. And we're getting close. So we'd been working on it, and then the pandemic hit, and of course that derailed many things and many well-laid plans, and we weren't able to, you know, to meet as often and pivoted and tried to do some of it via Zoom. But we're at the point now where we have proposed language for the marker. And let me back up a step. There's the Equal Justice Initiative out of Alabama. And if anyone saw the movie Just Mercy, it portrays the life of Brian Stevenson, who's the civil rights lawyer who founded the Equal Justice Initiative. And part of what they do, they have a lynching museum in Alabama, mm-hmm. and they work with local communities to bring lynching markers so that you can use history as a jumping off point, of course, to understand the past, but also have conversations in the present. And I feel like it allows us to talk about our shared humanity, to mm-hmm. talk about racism, to talk about all of these things that sometimes are very uncomfortable, let's just say, to talk about. And so Councilman Vieira had the idea that we wanted to bring one of these lynching markers to Tampa. And in preparing for this work and working on this project, I learned more history about Florida. I mean, I have always considered Florida a part of the South, and growing up in Polk County, I certainly understood that there were lynchings, especially along the Peace mm-hmm. River, which runs throughout Polk County. But what I didn't know is that Florida, there was a time where Florida was the lynching capita of the country.
Yep.
Per capita, Florida had more lynchings than any other state. More than Mississippi, more than Alabama, more than those states that I think we try to distinguish ourselves from. Mm-hmm. Like, no, that's, you know, that's not who we are as Florida, but it is a part of who we've been, and we need to talk about it. So we've got language for the marker. We're now looking for a location. We've also been working with Hillsborough County Public Schools to make sure that conversation around this education can be a part of curriculum that students can learn about. So it's come a very long way, and I'm optimistic that we'll soon have a location for the marker.
Great. We'll be following that. So you've got three sessions under your belt now in Tallahassee, right? 2019, 20, and 21.
That's right.
And so this will be your fourth. Tell me, how does the first session compare to the last session, and what are the most important lessons you've learned?
Wow, what a great question, Janet. Look at you giving Oprah a run for her money. That was a great question. First session, nobody knows what the heck they're doing.
Just trying to find your way around the hallways.
You are, and you're trying to learn, and it's like anything else in life that's new. I feel like it's like learning a new language, right? And kind of once you understand the rules of engagement and you become more fluent in that language, then you're able to maneuver in a way. I have a friend who describes it, though, like, and I've never been a quarterback, but always wished I could have been one, that if you're a quarterback and the more seasoned you get, I imagine, you know, here's looking at you, Tom Brady, it's not so much that the game changes, but it's like it slows down and you can understand and kind of read the movement on the field much better. And that's what it feels like the first session compared to this session. I'm in a leadership role now. I've been serving as policy chair for my caucus. So it's allowed me to get more in-depth with our policy, helping members with their bills, helping us to carry big initiatives. It's been great. It's also kind of wild to think that I'm entering my fourth session,
right,
which makes me middle-aged in terms of lawmaker years, because we're term limited out at 8 years. So, you know, it's been a great experience. It's the best thing I've ever done, for sure.
Are you already planning for next year? What's on tap? What can we look for from you
for next session?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So there was a bill that I was honored to carry. We actually partnered with Wharton High School to let some of their science students choose a bill that I would carry, an environmental bill. It's on food waste. It's an incredible bill that would divert tons and tons of food waste from large producers, including some of our big schools, big restaurants, divert that away from landfills and actually get it recycled into material that can be used and that can create new industries. It's possible to create fuel from all of this. So we're really excited about that. You know, of course, continuing the conversation on criminal justice reform and police reform and looking into, you know, possible solutions. What can we do there? So I think it's going to be an exciting session for sure.
I have an email from Mark who says, thank you for having Representative Driscoll on your show today. I'm such a fan of hers and see her as a bright light in Florida's future. So that's a fan mail for you.
Thank you, Mark.
And if any you all have a question or want to just say something nice about Representative Driscoll, send us an email at dj@wmnf.org or give us a call at 813-239-9663. So Mark is a fan, and I'm wondering, do you see yourself as a role model? You talked about some of your mentors. We talked about your sister, and I'm wondering if you have any other mentors that you'd like to talk about, and are you a mentor for anyone, and do you see yourself as a role model?
You know, that's a great question. So there are many, I feel like I have many wonderful role models who I look up to, both in my professional capacity as a lawyer. Because as a young lawyer, it's quite like being an apprentice, because you graduate from law school knowing how to think as a lawyer, but you have no idea how to practice. And so I've had many great role models and mentors in my career, Nancy Faginelli, Bob Quinn, Gwen Young, who've taught me how to be a good lawyer. With respect to politics, I know I stand on strong shoulders. So Senator Athenia Joyner, for one, who is just, she's broken through so many barriers. Mm-hmm. She's also from Polk County, just right. like me. She's a lawyer, just like me. She's a strong Black woman, just like me. I mean, she's someone who I really hold as an inspiration, but also she's so aspirational for me. So there are many.
I think do you have a picture of Betty Castor hanging in your office?
I do. So I have a wall full of strong women. And former senator and commissioner, education commissioner, and USF president Betty Castor is one of them. Also have Gwen S. Cherry, who I never got a chance to know, mm-hmm. but she is the first Black woman who served in the Florida legislature.
From South Florida. She's a separate woman.
Yep. That's right.
And I wrote a little story about her for the Florida Humanities magazine, actually. So I got to know about her recently. She's very cool.
Very cool, right?
Yeah,
a lot of great role models.
We've got, Tamara from St. Pete on the line. So Tamara from St. Pete, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I just wanted to say to Representative Driscoll, it's been really interesting listening to you, but also I actually have a friend, going back to your lynching memorial, I have a friend who's 91 that actually remembers a lynching in St. Petersburg around Central, or what do I want to say, First Avenue South. Hmm. And I just wanted to, talk to you about that.
Oh, Tamara, thank you. Thank you for your call. That's very intense.
So my friend can remember the days that she had to close her blinds in order to keep the Ku Klux Klan from spotting, you know, any lights in the house. And so it's just really interesting. It's right here in St. Pete, which is, like you said, the capital. Florida was the capital of lynchings. But, yeah, so.
When St. Pete was very divided, I think that there was, I think Central Avenue divided St. Pete, and no Black people were allowed to live north of Central Avenue. I think that was the case.
Yeah, well, it's sweet justice that my friend sits on a house that doesn't need flood insurance. So it's her little area that doesn't need that. But anyway, yeah, sorry for the emotions, but yeah, it's a huge
thing
tough to witness.
I know when I was reading about this a little bit, reading some of the stories, they're very horrific. They're newspaper clippings and that you can actually read. Very horrific.
Ida B. Wells kind of, you know, enlightened me. I read a book by her granddaughter just recently, and how Ida B. Wells, her thing was keeping data on lynchings, is how she started with her data journalism. I thought that was really very enlightening and just stuff that we need to know about.
Well, thanks for the call, Tamara. I appreciate that. We appreciate it. And of course, Representative Driscoll is working on getting some of that memorialized here in Tampa honoring those people.
So what I'm thinking then is when it comes to that, you know, like, I just need to look at her website and see if maybe somebody can contact my friend about this.
Why don't you go ahead and send an email to dj@wmnf.org, and I will forward it to the representative.
Okay, I appreciate it. That's what I needed to know. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. All thanks, Tamara. I appreciate it very much.
Bye.
Wow, that was an intense phone call.
You know, but Tamara, thank you for calling in, and don't worry about the emotion at all, because it is emotional and it's intense. And, you know, thank you for just sharing that you have a friend who is still alive and who remembers,
mm-hmm.
you know, who was a witness to that. And I think that in modern American society, because maybe it's just human nature, Janet, I don't know, but we feel removed from that time. But I think it's important for us to remember that and have conversations in present day and try to understand how it informs our situations present day when we talk about things like systemic racism, when we talk about things like implicit bias. You know, I think it's important to understand history and to understand how we're in the situation that we're in. I have a friend who always says, fish can't see the water they're swimming in. They can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any more sometimes, I think, than we would, unless we're intentional about it, pause and kind of understand how we got to a place. And so, Tamara, I appreciate that. Please do email, because I'd love to reach out. Can I mention one other thing, Janet?
Sure, of course.
Pockets? Topics. Tamara mentioned Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells was just a revolutionary in her time. And she also marched for women's suffrage. There was a women's suffrage march in Washington, D.C. on March 3rd, 1918, I think it was. And that actually was the first public act of community service by Delta Sigma Theta sorority, of which I am honored to be a member. And Ida B. Wells and the members of Delta Sigma Theta, even though, because they were Black women, they were relegated to marching in the back,
mm-hmm.
They still stood up for women's rights everywhere. Actually, I think Ida, she wasn't having it, and so sometimes she would just kind of walk around everybody and you know, head up to the front. But just wanted to also acknowledge that important history of Delta Sigma Theta and Ida B. Wells.
Well, you were talking about, it seems like a long time ago, but it's not really. And you talked about Senator Joyner, and I've talked to her before about it. And she talks about growing up in Lakeland and her family closing the blinds when the Ku Klux Klan was marching through the streets because they didn't want anybody to know that they were home. So she remembers that. And then the story about the Groveland Four, the book about the Groveland Four, and I forget them blanking out on the name of the
Devil
book.
Devil in the Grove.
Devil in the Grove,
yeah.
Exactly. The sheriff who was responsible for murdering those kids was sheriff until the 1970s.
Right.
So it's, you know, in my lifetime, in your lifetime, there are many of us who were around when those things were happening still, and it's important to honor them and remember them so that we don't forget and we don't become the fish not seeing the water that we're in.
During my first legislative session, I was there during a clemency board meeting with the governor and the other executive officers where they actually granted posthumously a pardon to the boys, the Groveland young men, Black men who had been wrongfully accused of raping a white woman. And the alleged victim was there. Her family was there to give. She was there, and her family was there to give testimony on
wow.
her behalf. But the clemency board voted unanimously. It was an easy vote to take, understanding the history of what had happened. But
right.
yes, I recommend that book to anyone. Devil in the Grove by Gilbert King. It won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, it's incredible. Hard to read, but incredible and an important book to read. I want to move on to another topic. We've got redistricting coming up, and I want you to talk a little bit as we're getting ready to close out the show about what's at stake with that and what we should be paying attention to.
Mm-hmm. Everything's at stake with redistricting. I cannot underscore that enough. Every 10 years, based on the census count, a state will redraw its legislative district lines, both for the state level and the congressional level. In some other states, there are nonpartisan, impartial commissions that are appointed to do this. That is not the case in Florida. The Florida legislature will be drawing these lines. So in other words, we'll be policing ourselves to draw lines that may favor or disfavor, you know, any particular
candidate. And it's a Republican-led legislature. So they're going to have, the Republicans will have more say.
That's right, right? They certainly have an advantage in terms of having the numbers. But what I would encourage the people to do is please pay attention to this. The way it typically works is that the redistricting committees would hold meetings around the state and get public input on the maps. We typically would have started that process much sooner, but due to COVID, there was a delay in getting the census data. Long story short is that this process is about to start up. So I would encourage you, for all the listeners out there, to make sure that you are in contact with your state representative and state senator as we go through this process, and make sure that your voice is heard with respect to redistricting, because it, you know, we've had litigation in Florida. We've got a constitutional amendment on fair districts, and that's great. And we would hope that the legislature would do the right thing. But public, we need you to be engaged. Keep us accountable and make sure that we draw these maps fairly, because it's going to determine what our districts look like and what the balance of power in Florida is going to be for the next decade. So it's incredibly important. And it has implications, of course, in terms of presidential elections. Florida mm-hmm. just gained a congressional seat, which means we, you know, gain that, you know, that much more
weight
in the electoral college, right? So this has significant impact. So please, please pay attention and stay engaged with us.
Yeah, and they might, they're thinking that they might try to redraw the seat that Charlie Crist now holds, that to make it more favorable for Republicans, which would make it difficult, which would mean that would start shifting the balance in the House of Representatives in D.C. So that makes a big difference.
That makes a huge difference, right? Because I think right now the Democrats have a four-member advantage.
Slim
advantage. And I'll just say, you know, I see it in the legislature. I think that we govern best when we're more balanced. And I think the Florida legislature is far out of balance, right? There are only 42 Democrats compared to 78 Republicans. And please hear me when I say that balance, it's not, it could be that there were a ton of Democrats and very few Republicans. What I'm trying to suggest is that our state is actually quite purple. Mm-hmm. You know, we're quite evenly divided. And anytime that you have things so far out of balance, it's very difficult to get legislation and policy that is reflective, I think, of what the people truly want. So that's why redistricting matters so much. It should matter to you, to our listeners, because you want to make sure that your voice is heard and that, you know, no one party or no one candidate is drawing districts in a way that is unfavorable and it would, you know, diminish your ability to have your voice heard. That's the point.
Well, and the districts will be part of a bill. Is that right? Is that how it works in the legislature? And so people will actually be able to weigh in somehow?
So the way it's supposed to work, right, we're supposed to have a redistricting main committee and then two subcommittees. The redistricting committee is supposed to go around the state and actually engage and get public feedback on how the maps are drawn. And then the legislature will vote on these maps. So coming out of the 2022 session.
Yeah,
time is moving fast. We will have our new maps, and those will be the districts that will shape the 2022 elections and all elections going forward.
So are there any races in particular that you're watching really closely in 2022? Let's talk about those a little bit. Obviously, there's the governor's race, but we have a U.S. Senate race that's kind of interesting, too, with Val Demings and Marco Rubio.
We do. And can I tell you, so I've been a big fan of Val Demings, Congressman Demings, for a very long time. I mean, talk about someone who has broken barriers, right? The first black woman police chief over in Orlando, and a congresswoman and an impeachment officer. She has done amazing things, but I was, we were both in Lakeland for the NAACP's Freedom Fund dinner a few weeks back, and the audience just was hanging on to her every word. I'm convinced that for Democrats, she is our greatest hope. She's going to be the coattails that hopefully, you know, lifts all boats, and I can't wait to see what she does, because I think that Senator Rubio's, he's gotten out of touch with the people of mm-hmm. Florida. Yeah, he seems like he's in touch with his base in Miami, but Florida's so much more than Miami, right? And I've been disappointed in him, especially how he's handling pandemics, you know, the pandemic and the kind of misinformation that he puts out there. And it's just, it's been very troubling to me. And I think we need balance here in Florida, and we could use a Democratic senator to help bring that.
And when there's a poll, the most recent poll I saw does not bode well right now for Val Demings, though, actually.
I mean, it's tough, right? Marco Rubio's been in office a very long time. You're talking about a guy who was a former speaker of the Florida House. So, you know, he certainly has a lot of name ID, but I would also contend that it's early, right? We're sitting in August 2021. It's a long time away from November 2022, and you never know what could happen or things could change. I mean, you know, heck, I would say probably just a month ago, people would say that Governor DeSantis had armor that was impenetrable, but we see his favorable numbers slipping because of the way that he has been mishandling the pandemic and the missteps that he's making with respect to our school districts and trying to put them on their heels and not letting them do what they need to do to keep our kids safe. So it's early. There's time yet, and she's dynamic. And I think when she gets introduced to the people of Florida on a larger scale, maybe we'll see those numbers start to shift.
It is early, but we'll keep on watching it. So a year goes by very quickly.
It does.
Just to finish out here, I want to ask you two final questions. My first one is going to be, after 4 years, I'm going to ask you first, what is your biggest disappointment? And then what are you most proud of that you've accomplished in your first 3 years as a lawmaker? So start with, what's your biggest disappointment? So we can go out on a positive note.
Yeah, that's tough. Biggest disappointment. I mean, there's so many, right? Because I'm in the minority party in the Florida House. So the biggest disappointment, of course, is that I don't get to accomplish the really big policy ideas that I have, you know, the things that I want to do for our public schools, restoring public education to the jewel that I believe it's supposed to be, that gives every kid the best pathway forward to achieve success in life, the freedom to be healthy, prosperous, and safe. So that's frustrating, you know. But my greatest accomplishment, hands down, the police reform bill. I'm so very proud of that. And I think it's an important step in the right direction for the future of Florida. And I think it's more reflective of the Florida that we want to be. And so I'm glad to have been a part of that.
Great. And what can we expect next from you? I know you're going to be the minority leader, the House Democratic leader in 2024. And after that, any thoughts that you're thinking at all about what the future holds? And I know it's really early to ask that, but I can't resist.
It's really early to add that. And this is not even playing coy. It is a lot of work trying to lead a caucus. And I'm seeing that as policy chair. So that is absolutely what I'm focused on. And what that means as leader, I'm leader designate now. So what that means is that leading up to the 2024 election, I help with the elections, right? Like I help to raise money and support candidates. It's like a whole additional job in addition to everything else I have on my plate. So I'm focused on being the best policy chair and designate I can be. And then, you know, so we have the best chance of success in 2024.
Great. Thanks so much for being with us today, Representative Driscoll. I really appreciate it. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. I'm Janet Scherberger. This is Midpoint. We had Lamar Robinson answering the phones for us today. Stay tuned for NPR News, followed by Talking with the Animals with Duncan Strauss.